Jody Kay, I met at the Roll of Nickels group, which meets Thursday nights at 7 p.m. just across the river in Hudson, Wisconsin. Yeah. Jody's been a big part of my recovery, and I am so, so very grateful that she's part of my life. Jody Kay, everybody.
If you can't see this, it says Jody Rocks. That's so cute. Hi, my name is Jody, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jody.
And when Lindsay asked me if I wanted to do this, the first thing that screams through your head, my head always, is no. But because of good sponsorship, I've been taught that whenever available, you need to say yes. So I said yes and spent the day in panicking. But I do want to thank you all for the invitation to learn once again how to do something scared. It's so important. My second sponsor used to always say, just do it, scared. And so for me, that's what this is about. Our big book says we're supposed to talk a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. So that's what I'm planning on doing tonight. We had some unwritten rules in our house when I was growing up. The unwritten rules always were, you can't ever be too thin and you can't ever be too rich. Criticism was seen as encouragement, and nothing ever felt good enough. I basically couldn't be seen with any of you growing up. You were either too cute, too smart, too funny, too artistic, everybody else was too something. And I never felt like I measured up to any of you. When I was in maybe sixth or seventh grade, I brought home all A's. And I remember one of my parents saying to me, "Wow, if you'd have done just a little bit of homework, maybe you could get A pluses." And when I became a size 5 and my mom took me shopping, she went, "Oh, you're a size 5 now?" So I assumed she meant I was fat. When I came home with all A's and they told me maybe if you'd studied a little bit, they could have been A pluses, I didn't hear maybe if I'd studied a little bit, they could be A pluses. I heard you're stupid. And then when I got a first job, it was a part-time job, and I remember distinctly my dad saying, maybe someday you'll amount to something. I think he meant maybe someday you'll amount to something. I heard him say, you'll never amount to anything. I did not hear what people said. While I was growing up, my dad was a cop. I grew up in Oakdale, so if you've ever been arrested in Oakdale, maybe you've been arrested by my father. I'm here to proudly say I've never been arrested by my father. Because my dad was a cop, I felt I had something to prove. So I put my hand in the hand of some pretty dangerous people. And I thought that would prove that I was good enough to be a cop's daughter. We only drank confiscated booze in my house. Can't take open bottles into court. Guess who drinks it? I'm just saying. I became a blackout drinker from the get-go. So I'd love to tell you some great drunk stories, but they'd all be hearsay because I don't remember anything. I was a total blackout drinker. So perhaps someone else can tell my story about what used to happen when I got drunk. Anything I told you would be hearsay and therefore probably a lie. So I won't do that. So I grew up, I became a party girl, different bars, different nights. Different people, different bars, different nights. And one night I'm in a bar and I see him. And I walk across the room and I walk up to him and I say, "Hi, you're really cute. Do you want to go out?" And he said, "Sure." So 3 months later we got married. Because that's what we do. So on our honeymoon, my husband had some cocktails and went to play poker with some people he'd met at the hotel that we were staying at on our honeymoon. So now I'm stupid, I'm fat, I'm never going to amount to anything, and I can't possibly be a good wife if my husband had way too many cocktails and left on our honeymoon. So this was the excuse that I used to drink for 7 years. We had a couple kids. The violence in our home got worse. The violence that I need to own up to is that I have a violent mouth. You look at me wrong and I will shred you with words, and I'm good. And I knew I was good, and I used that to every advantage that I could. Then one night, my husband comes home and he'd been drinking again, and I didn't know what sick and tired and sick of being sick and tired was at the time, but I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I put the kids to bed early, I lit the candles, I put on the outfit, and I waited. I was going to make my marriage better. And I waited, and I waited, and I waited. And he came home and went, "Wow," and ran in the bathroom and puked all over everything. He decided he was going to kill himself and left, and I was happy because I was also a martyr, and then people would feel sorry for me. I had the insurance money spent before he was out the driveway. He woke up in treatment. And I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to feel and have gratitude in Alcoholics Anonymous from the very beginning. I learned about intimacy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned that intimacy is into me see. I learned how to let you see into me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned, though, that not always, I started in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon because I didn't want to be sick like you people. So I just have to tell this story. They taught me, and I hung out with a bunch of alcoholics because I was hanging out with people my husband was hanging out with. And you know, when you remove alcohol from alcoholic, you get ick. So the alcohol was removed from this alcoholic, and I was going to Al-Anon, but I was pretty much basically ick. One night, my husband brought me to an open meeting, and it was an Ask a Basket call-up meeting where people drew subjects out of a basket and spoke for 3 to 5 minutes. And a gentleman stood up, did what he was going to do, and then he pointed to me. And he said, "I'd like you to come up here. You're not in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm pretty sure you should be." I don't remember what I said. I don't remember the question I drew out of the basket, but I got thirsty. I got real thirsty. And I switched rooms. And that was October 10th, 1983. I have not found it necessary to take a drink or a drug since then. So that moved me from a life of enslavement into a life of empowerment. But it came at a cost. It came at a cost of the 12 steps. And that's what it's like for me today. Today it's all about the steps, so that's what I'd like to talk about, are the steps. The first time at our club, I live in New Richmond, Wisconsin, we have a little club, and the first time at the club, I wasn't afraid of anything or anybody ever, ever, ever in my whole life. I was afraid to walk back in that club and go to a meeting. That petrified me. Then I learned about sponsorship. Then I learned about caring. Then I learned about intimacy. The women held me up and carried me forward. And I'm so grateful for those women in early recovery. So I learned about step one. There's a problem. It's me. In this book, this is a big book. If you don't have one, I suggest you get one. If you don't have one and don't know how to get one, see me after. I'll tell you all about it. On page 27 in this book, it says, where is it? I wrote it down. It says, you have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. That's what the sixth line in the big book says. I think my mind is out to get me. I think that the neurological disease of alcoholism, this part of my brain wants to be a good wife. This part of my brain wants to be a good mother. This part of my brain wants to be an amazing employee and a good friend. And this part of my brain wants to drink. And this part of my brain keeps winning. Unless I go to meetings and work the steps. I think I became addicted to the state of intoxication, and I think that Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the few things that helps me combat those feelings. Step two for me, if step one is there's a problem and it's me, step two is there's a solution and it's not me. The second step does not mention a higher power. My sponsor had me make a list of higher powers. She said to me, are you the greatest power in the universe? No. She had me make a list of powers greater than me. The police, my boss, a collective group of alcoholics. And then I got to move on. My prayer when my husband left to kill himself that night used to be, please God, kill him, because I didn't love the violence. And when I was working on my second step, I was actually in treatment for codependency at that time and working on my second step. And I would throw my homework away and the counselor would get mad at me, so I'd throw it away some more. And I was on my way home. I got to go to treatment 2 miles from our house. I also got to go to AA 2 miles from our house. The treatment center and the Alano Club are literally across the street from each other. So I leave treatment, I'm on my way home, I stop at the grocery store, and I said the first prayer that wasn't, please God, kill him, in 7 years. There was a box inside the door where you're supposed to fill out your name and your phone number and win fabulous prizes. So as I'm writing my name and my phone number, I said the first prayer, I said, please, God, it's almost Christmas. If you're real, could my kids have a Christmas this year? I folded up the piece of paper, threw it in the box, got what I needed to get for the kids, and went home. As I'm pulling in the driveway, Dave comes out of the house with the phone. He says, telephone, it's some guy. I say hello. Between the grocery store and my house, they had picked up that box, shaken that box, reached in that box, and pulled out my name. We want enough money to have Christmas that year. My higher power needs to hit me upside the head with a 2x4 before I get it sometimes. I did not have a problem with a higher power after that. Shortly after that, my husband had me go to my very first open meeting, and because he's a good AA, I was not a good AA in the beginning, because he was a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous, he walked me down front and sat me in the front row. And, oh, we're in St. Paul. Mary Jo Robinson, anybody who has been here a long time and remembers Mary Jo Robinson, she spoke that night. And when I found out that she ran a place called the Christ Recovery Center, I was so like, I do not want anything that woman has. And after her speech, she had two people stand up and hold her hands. And she said, in step three, we talk a lot about God. If you're holding the hand of an alcoholic here and the hand of an alcoholic here, you don't have a hand left to pick up a drink. And three's a higher number than one, and that's a good place to start. Thank you to my husband. Thank you to Mary Jo. Thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. It got me on the road to refinding my higher power. So in step three, I got to take the problem, which is me, and the solution, which is not me, and put them together. I happen to believe in the same higher power that the guys that wrote the big book believe in, but I don't want anybody else to feel like they have to believe in the same higher power as me, so I'm real careful about saying, I put the problem me, the solution my higher power together, and we got to work. we did some action. I learned from reading that God is love. Anytime I experience love, that's God in action for me. Sometimes the higher power speaks and your lips are moving. Sometimes the higher power works through action of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. My God is amazing for me. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous I heard someone say in a meeting one time that every time she goes over a bridge, she says, "It's your will, it's not mine, it's none of my business." So after the meeting, I went up and asked her what that was about, and she said, "It keeps me in my program, it keeps me out of other people's programs." And I asked her if I could borrow that prayer, and she said, "No, you can have it. We give things away in AA." And we drove over a whole lot of bridges here, and I lost count. Another little prayer I like to do is when I'm painting out my happy face in the morning, I like to look into my own eyes and say, "Not everybody has a big book. You might be the only living example of the big book that someone sees today. Please don't screw it up." I like to tell myself that because if I don't tell myself stuff like that, I'll screw it up. There are two schools of thought on steps 4 and 5. Some people believe that you do them once and then you're done. And some people believe that you do them more than once. I happen to be of the second school of thought. Every single time I walk a newcomer through the steps, I do the steps with them, which keeps me current on all of my steps. I learned through doing multiple 4th and 5th steps that feelings aren't facts. I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we say, "How you doing?" because we don't care how you're feeling. And we learned that God doesn't make junk. I have a disease of perception and loneliness. If I stay current in my steps, my perception is in check, and I'm not lonely. Step 6 and 7 for me is about remaining teachable. I don't have to listen to what my friends in Canada call the itty-bitty shitty committee in my head. I don't have to listen to that anymore. I get to be right-sized. I get to let you see me exactly the way I am. I get to practice intimacy into me see. Because of step 6 and 7, it keeps me right-sized. I learned that my defects are assets. I learned that all my defects are also my greatest assets. I'm a really hard worker. Some people can see that as controlling in the right situation. I'm pretty creative. If I hide in my basement and get creative for 3 weeks, that's actually called isolation. I have a great sense of humor. Sarcasm is my favorite thing. Is that truly humor, or is that shredding you with words in a different way? All of my assets are also defects. It looks the same sometimes on the outside, but I know in my gut what's true and what isn't. We had a couple kids, Dave and I, and we got to practice on them as good members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when our youngest was 5 or 6, he would have trouble sleeping. And he would say, "Maybe I don't need to be here anymore." And he would hide a lot. I would find him in his closet hiding. So we came up with this theory that if you're not feeling too good, instead of hiding, no matter what time of the day or night it is, come give me a poke and I'll tell you I love you. And if he had to come in and wake me up at night and give me a couple of pokes, I knew we were in for a bad night. So one night he comes in for the second or the third time, and I'm like, "Hi, I love you." And he says, "Mommy, I've been thinking, Mommy. I've been thinking about all the people who like me or love me or maybe just care about me a little bit, Mommy, and I need you to know I'm up to 63. I learned that day that we can be, as a couple, my husband and I, powerful members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can be productive members of society, and that parenting can happen in recovery. My program is my business. Your program is your business. I try to stay in my hula hoop. According to the big book on page 417, I try to find a little bit of good in the worst of us. And if I'm truly practicing step seven, another goal of mine is to become just a little bit less important to even more people. Then the promises started to come true for me. My favorite promise is that I will intuitively know. I'm not very good at it. I don't always listen. My higher power hits me upside the head with a 2x4, but I don't always pay attention. About 15 years into recovery, I got to do this really cool job. It wasn't with AA, it was with a treatment center, but I got to host online meetings. And I met this woman from Ireland in my very first online meeting. And she had like 6 months of sobriety, and she was tons of fun, and when it's morning here, it's night there, and the times, and it was so much fun. And as we're typing back and forth one day, I was being all Minnesota nice. You know, Minnesota's not really nice. It's kind of passive aggressive. You know that, right? All right. So I'm being all Minnesota nice, and I say, if you ever get to Minnesota, I've got a spare couch. She booked a flight. I got to go home and tell my shy, quiet, introverted husband that a woman I've never met before except on the internet was coming to stay at our house for 10 days. She then pinged another woman that was in the chat room from California and said, I'm sure Jody has two couches, why don't you show up too? And she did. She landed in the United States on her 1 year sobriety birthday. And we had a blast. Well, fast forward a year, she says, I came to the United States, it's your turn to come to Ireland. I had never traveled alone before, I didn't have a passport, I'd never flown over the ocean, and I was scared, and my sponsor told me to just do it scared. About a week before I was supposed to leave for Ireland, she called, which was rather rare, and she said, I've booked you on a speaking tour in my country. I had never told my story before. I wanted to cancel my trip, but I have a sponsor. And she told me to shut up, suck it up, and do it scared. So I did. The very first place I spoke was a convent that was turned into a treatment center. The nuns ran the treatment center. And I was even more scared than I am right now. Projectile vomiting could have happened. I mean, I was petrified. So I get up, and I'm scared I'm going to use the wrong slang terms because they speak the Queen's English, and I'd never told my story before, and I was freaking out. And afterwards, I said to my friend Fiona, Fiona, please, how did I do? And she said, Ach, Jody, please, never put the words fuck and nun in the same sentence ever again. So I'm back from Ireland, and it's spring, and the lilacs are getting ready to bloom, and lilacs are my absolute all-time favorite flower, and we have a huge, huge row of lilac bushes along the back of our property. It's amazing. And just before they're going to bloom, my husband made a lilac hedge, and he was going to die. But I have a sponsor. And she said, you don't get to kill your husband, you get to go for a walk. Walk? Okay. You know what it's like when you're really angry and you go for a walk? You don't go for a walk, do you? You stomp. So I'm stomping, and I'm thinking, I don't know who she thinks she is, but he's going to die. And I'm stomping, and I'm about a half a mile from home, and I smell lilacs. And I look over, and there is a perfect lilac bush in full bloom. So I trudge across this little field and I start snapping off lilacs, and I'm super not kidding, I had a few. And I hear behind me, and I turn around and there's one of New Richmond's finest police officers. And he says, "Lady, what are you doing?" And I don't have a filter. And I say, "These lilacs need to be in my kitchen or my husband's gonna die." And he gives me this really weird look. And do you guys watch Charlie Brown at this time of the year? That's what I hear when cops talk. Wah, wah, wah. So he said something about trespass on private property, theft from private property, destruction of private, wah, wah, wah. And then he did the old, "What do you have to say for yourself?" And I said, I'm telling you, these need to be in my kitchen. And he goes, "You know who owns this property?" And I said, "No." And he said, "The nuns that work at the New Richmond Hospital. So this is going to be between you and God." And he turned around, got in his car, and drove away. Those lilacs got to be on my kitchen table. Moral of the story, I steal lilacs every year because I can. For me, fear is the greatest barrier to gratitude. I need to learn to practice love by restraint. Those are hard lessons for me. I need to stay inside my hula hoop. If I can practice love by restraint instead of other people's business, my program goes ever so much better. If I remember to lead with my heart and use restraint instead of my head, I'm able to get out of my own way before I hurt somebody. It works. I made some of my amends by actively listening to people. I was not a very good listener when I was new here. I learned that by actively listening to people, you can really hear them, and you can figure out what the best way to make amends is. I need to use the ear that's in my heart when I'm listening to people, because sometimes you guys are God with skin on for me. I learned, my spiritual advisor always taught me that there were two sides to every issue. Ernie taught me that there was love and there was fear. If I'm practicing love, I'm going through life with my arms wide open. If I'm practicing fear, every single one of my sphincters is tightened up because you're all gonna go. I try really hard to keep it open and to practice love. That, for me, is what it's about. I told you I had two kids. Our oldest one started drinking in college. He'd call and do things and say things that I used to do and say. He'd call and he'd say, "Guess what I just did? I have your genetic makeup." And I'd be like, but it was always like 3 o'clock in the morning. So we made a plan. Remember what you used to feel like at 7 a.m. on Sunday? Oh yeah, we called him at 7 a.m. on Sunday. And we said, "You may not ever need a chair in Alcoholics Anonymous, but you don't get to call us and tell us your stories anymore. Find somebody new to tell your stories to, but we will always save you a chair in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous if you need it." My higher power takes care of me. His higher power takes care of him. I try really hard to stay out of his business. Our youngest child, the one that found 63 people to love and care about and like just a little bit, when he was a senior in high school, he tried to die, and I found him. And I learned from people in Alcoholics Anonymous to only show up at the hospital during visiting hours. I learned from the people in Alcoholics Anonymous to keep eating 3 square meals a day, because if you're sick, you're not going to be any good for him. I learned from the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that you need to get a few hours sleep every night, because you're not going to be any good to anybody if you're too tired. And I learned from people in Alcoholics Anonymous that if I don't keep going to meetings, I'm not going to be any good to him. Not only did he live, but he made us grandparents for the very first time. I used to call him once a year on the anniversary and say, "I'm glad you didn't cack." And he'd be like, "Thanks, Mom." But I don't do that anymore. We've kind of moved past it. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I learned this resentment prayer. I considered my mom to be the abuser in my life. And then someone taught me this little resentment prayer, and I started to say it. I was 30 years sober My mother hugged me and told me she loved me for the very first time. I don't think my ma changed. I think I got to change in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to accept her for exactly who she is. My dad got sick. My dad, the cop, got sick, and they told us he was going to pass in about 72 hours when he slipped into the coma. He lived for like 12 days, and I got to climb into bed with him and play with his hair and tell him I loved him. I got to be exactly the kind of daughter I always wanted to be, but being a crazy child living in a crazy household and then a raging alcoholic prevented me from that. When my dad was sick and in the coma, I was healthy enough, finally, to be a good daughter. I got to make those kinds of amends with my dad before he passed away. I learned one other thing from my spiritual advisor that was incredibly important to me. I learned that pain becomes power when it's held up to grace. The pain of Dan's near suicide, the pain of our oldest son when he was drinking, the pain of the abuse from my mom, the pain of the issues I had with my dad. If I hold them up to the grace of the 12 steps in my higher power and heal from that, that gets to be power to help someone else someday. And I'm so grateful for that. On page 417 of the big book, it says that we get to find a bit of good in the worst of us. I even got to find a bit of good in me. And that makes me so happy. I got to make some living amends. I got to go into a prison for 14 years and take ladies without a guard outside the walls to their very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those were my living amends to the community. I don't remember all the people I stole from. Those were my living amends, was helping those ladies in prison. What they didn't know is how much they taught me about freedom. What they didn't know is how much they taught me about grace. What they didn't know is how much they taught me about keeping a healthy sobriety. They taught me how to accept a compliment. One called me on my stuff one day and said, she said something about my hair looking nice, and I was like, whatever. And she said, if you don't accept a compliment, that's like you're calling me a liar. Burn, yeah. For me, the last three steps are not really maintenance. Step 10 talks about continuing, step 11 talks about seeking and improving, and step 12 talks about in all our affairs. There's no room in there for maintenance, people. It's kind of like you're going up a down escalator. If you stand still, you end up on the ground. For me, I have to stay busy. 10th step for me is the walking around step. I can be walking around anywhere I want and then take my 10th step inventory. Recovery's like this really long road, and the people that got the books back there, congratulations, by the way, the people that got the books back there might be here on a road. I might be here on the recovery road, but we're all exactly the same distance from the ditch. If I don't keep my recovery current, I can go in the ditch just as quick as somebody else with one day. I have to keep my recovery current. It's muscle memory for me. If I work the steps really hard, it's a lot of work. If I live the steps, it's my life. It becomes muscle memory. It's kind of like you can't get wet reading the word water. It's kind of like that. You have to get in there and be in the middle. If I'm not in the middle, I'm not doing it. Step 11 for me is simple. I say please in the morning. I say thank you in the afternoon. Actively listening is a form of meditation for me, but I don't always listen. Once again, am I going through life with hands open, or am I going through life with my hands closed? My higher power takes care of me. Their higher powers take care of them. It's none of my business. I have to stay in my own hula hoop. According to the World Health Organization, an alcoholic death happens every 10 seconds. Think about that. That's 6 people a minute. If we don't practice these principles in all our affairs, and if somebody can't see the big book in us, That's like we're letting people die. There's an urgency in getting the message out there for me. My higher power takes care of me. Their higher powers take care of them. But I still need to be a living example every single day in any way that I can. I can't save everybody, but I sure can help my neighbors if I see them. The first three steps taught me how to give up. 4 through 6 taught me how to own up. 7 through 9 taught me how to make up. And 10 through 12 are teaching me very slowly how to grow up. In the big book, it says that we need, our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. I need to do that every day, which means I no longer get to plan a murder. I have to love and like people today. My higher power takes care of me. We're grandparents now. We get to practice a new love and a new gratitude. I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I never stopped loving my husband, even when I was praying for him to die. But I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous how to like him. And we've been married 43 years. I think that thanks to my higher power, I'm a better person than I would ever deserve to be. Seriously. But I am in the fight of my life. It is normal for alcoholics to drink. Every single day we stay sober, we are doing what's not normal. I read this fairly early in recovery, so I had to write this down. Your task is not to seek gratitude, but it's to find the barriers in yourself that you've built against it. I need to remember to build bridges, not walls. So I get asked to do this, not very often, but every so often I kind of get asked to go out about and do this. And a while back, we were asked to go to Oshkosh, Wisconsin for a state conference. And I'm scared. And I'm pacing in the room. And I'm freaking out. And my husband's sitting on the bed like this, and he's kind of watching me. And all of a sudden, he takes a deep breath and he goes, "You know what? You never dress like a skank anymore." What I learned about myself that day is that I dress differently, I look differently, I talk differently. I'm a completely different person than the woman he married. Thank God. And thank Alcoholics Anonymous that we get to be and grow into such amazing, amazing men and women. So to prove it, as we're walking down the hall for me to speak, there was this really cool saying on the wall, so I stole it. And while I was talking, I had to talk about step 9, so I put it back. But I did write it down. And this is what it said. Not one of us is given a torch big enough to lead the drunks of this world out of the darkness and into the light. Instead, each of us has been given a candle that burns for a short while with a flickering flame. If we stand together, the light will outshine the greatest torch. If we argue and bicker and shield our own little flame, the alcoholics of the world will continue to suffer in darkness. And so will we.